Okay, but okay, right. Since two of the people dropped out, and we have a bit more time, I'm going to set myself a timer. and when that goes off, I'll stop. I've got way too much I could possibly talk about. And I want to really get into Nick's great questions, particularly freedom. I want to show how we can move from sort of trying to think about this initial question, what is freedom, to Nick's final question, which is what would an accelerationist aesthetics look like? These things are actually importantly connected as far as I'm concerned. However, again, just on format, if at any point I say something which is unclear, leap in. I mean, we can get the discussion afterwards, but it's important to have clarificatory questions. Right, okay. Freedom, what is it? I actually think it's important to distinguish between individual freedom and collective freedom. I think there is such a thing as a notion of collective freedom. A group or a society can be considered to be free and more or less free. But I'm going to start with individual freedom because that's the important concept, and you need to understand that before you can get to collective freedom. There's a certain kind of reflux there, but you know, we can discuss that later. Now, I think the other thing I will discuss as I go through is liberalism, because I think what the essence of liberalism is, and the people in the room who understand the political history far better than I do, but conceptually what I think the essence of liberalism is a misunderstanding of freedom. It's a call for freedom. Liberals want freedom. They just don't know what they want. And so, in talking about individual freedom and collective freedom, I'm going to explain what I think it is, but also what the misunderstanding is and how that leads to the situation we're in. Okay, so, what do I think freedom is? Nick said that, well, Nick's already announced that I'm really into Wilfred Sellers and Robert Random. But the reason I'm into these guys is that they're essentially the modern expressions of the tradition of German idealism, so Kant and Hegel particularly. In fact, you can actually look at Wilfred Sellers as being analytic philosophies of Immanuel Kant and Robert Random as being analytic philosophies, you know, Hegel. So I think there's an important sense in which what I'd like to bring to accelerationism is an appreciation of the themes of German idealism that were to some extent unjustly rejected in the middle of the 20th century and that need to be brought back. So, three distinctions. I think there are three important distinctions to make when you're talking about freedom, because the word can be used in all kinds of different ways. So firstly, there's a distinction between qualitative freedom and quantitative freedom. The ultimate qualitative distinction is, are you free or are you not, right? And what I mean by this is very much the kind of questions that Kant asked and that people like Heidegger and Sartre ask, because they very much thought there is a distinction between things that are free and things that are not. Sartre, in itself, for itself. I'm for itself, the bottle is just in itself. It's got no freedom, right? I think all this stuff about new materialism and materialism, All these positions that say, oh, we've got to think about things as having agency, they're just crap, they don't know what they mean by agency. There's a qualitative question as to what agency is, and it requires a serious answer, and Kant started giving us that answer. And what that answer basically amounts to is a functionalist story about what something has to be able to do in order to count as free. And at the core of that story is the idea that in order to be free, you have to be able to act. In order to be able to act, you have to be able to count as responsible for your actions. That's what distinguishes an action from an event, right? An event is just something that happens. An action is something that happens that you can ask, should it have happened, right? And in order to understand that question of responsibility, you have to be able to understand justification and reason giving. So what is it that characterizes qualitative freedom? Fundamentally, it is the capacity to give reasons, the capacity to understand reasons and to justify one's actions. There's a lot of qualifications that go on here, right? I don't have to be able to give the reasons that underlied every one of my actions in order to count them as actions. There's some wiggle room, but I'm not going to go into those complexities. I'm just dealing with the core concept. Now, what I think is really important to understand here is that when I say this is a functionalist story, I think that Kant essentially was doing artificial intelligence about 200 years before anybody else was. When Kant talks about faculties, you should just read information processing systems, right? What Kant is providing in his transcendental psychology is quite literally analogous to what Turing was providing with the account of the Turing machine. It's an account of what it takes to be a rational agent, which is independent of the meat. It's like you can have a rational agent made out of meat, you can have a rational agent made out of silicon, you can have a rational agent made out of an elaborate system of labyrinths and mice and bits of cheese, right? It can be instantiated in anything. What's important is the functional relationships between the different parts that compose it. Right. That's where qualitative freedom comes in. Being interested in the functional story regarding what it is to be something that can count as making decisions. Right? Quantitative freedom comes in when you want to start talking about things like capacities. Like how many things can you do? How free are you? And this leads us into the second distinction, which is the famous distinction Berlin makes between positive and negative freedom, which is basically the distinction between being able to do something and not being constrained. So it's the difference between having a positive capacity and not being constrained in the exercise of that capacity. And once you bring this into the qualitative-quantitative distinction, you start to see that we can think of both quantitative and qualitative levels of positive and negative freedoms. So just sticking to quantitative, like quantitative positive freedom is what Spinoza is interested in. What can a body do? Like maximize your power, right? Or just, you know, create joy, right? That for Spinoza, it's about quantitative positive freedom, right? Foucault, other end of the scale, quantitative negative freedom. Foucault at one point says freedom is a margin. You can be more or less free. And when he says this, he means you can be more or less free in relation to systems of control. There are various different systems of control, and you can be more or less determinable and predictable by those systems of control, right? And you can work on that. You can make yourself more free by making yourself harder to control, right? Okay.
So just to clarify, Spinoza you classify as positive freedom, Foucault as negative.
I think they both deal with both stories.
Okay.
It's just that I think the most interesting bit of both of them and the most famous bit of both of them are those bits.
Right, okay.
Now, the third distinction, which ties back into my initial story, is between what I call rational and actional capacities. So there's an important distinction to be made between your ability to do shit and your ability to decide to do shit, right? There is such a thing as being more able to make decisions. And this is really, really important because this is what liberalism doesn't understand, right? And you get this within basically most contemporary economics from like the 19th century onwards, right? When someone says more information in a system is always good, right? That's wrong because if you don't have the ability to process the information, it just becomes noise, right? So it's so like there's an appropriate level of information, and that appropriate level of information is determined by your rational capacities to actually make decisions. And there's a lot of consequences of that thought. Once you realise that, like, decisions don't just pop out of nowhere, right? There's this complicated functional story about how it is that we make the decisions and live in the world we live in, right? Lots and lots of things start becoming a lot more complicated in the way you think about society and sociality. Right, but I'll get back to that. How am I doing time-wise? Because I could just be going well, but no, okay, fine, I'm all right. Right, beauty. Beauty. This may seem like it comes out of nowhere. but I will tie it back in. So, there's an important split in the history of the concept of duty, starting all the way back in Plato, between a conception of duty as interested and fundamentally bound up with use, and a conception of duty as disinterested or fundamentally bound up with like higher things. And in fact, what's fascinating is you can see this split already in the interpretation of Socrates' opinion. So on the one hand, you've got the Symposium, where Plato, you know, basically provides this interpretation of Socrates in which it's all about the form of the beauty. Beauty in itself, right, is what you know, the stuff in the world is just kind of like pale imitations of things that beauty shines through. Whereas Xenophon, if you go and read his Socrates is really kind of obsessed with practicality. He actually says, you know, there isn't anything beautiful or good that is not beautiful or good for something. Right? You know, a house is beautiful because it's really good to live in. Rome is beautiful because it's very functional. That's it. That's all there is for beauty for Xenophon. And this tradition carries on and splits and develops in various ways. So on the one hand, you have people like Hume, for instance, who's all about beauty as utility. And then, more famously, Kant. Kant thinks beauty is all about disinterestedness. Right? If it's got a function, it's not beautiful in the authentic sense, as far as he's concerned. And I think that tradition is very interesting, because on the one hand, I think there's actually a point that both of them have, and we shouldn't pick one side, we should try and synthesize them. The other bit of this history is, that's a very formal definition of beauty. A more substantive definition of beauty you're going to find in both Kant and Hegel. So in Kant, basically condensing Kant right down with like a tiny little thing. Kant's view of beauty is essentially that it's a special kind of cognitive stimulation. Right? So Kant gives this functionalist story about how we process information in the world and how we go from experience to knowledge, right? And he thinks that beauty turns up as part of this story, right? But the way it turns up is, in essence, when we see beautiful things, they stimulate our faculties to just kind of go mad. And when he says go mad, it's not like disruption. It's like, wow, we just start drawing all these associations and we, you know, we truly test the limits of our cognitive capacities. And so if I can pick out a word, I'd say basically it's an account of beauty's inspiration, right? But it's an account of beauty's inspiration from this functionalist story about what freedom is. The other side of this substantive thing is Hegel, who has a completely different conception of beauty. But what's interesting about Hegel's conception of beauty is he thinks beauty is all about freedom. Right? He thinks that what beauty is the expression of the idea of freedom. And Hegel has a whole weird metaphysics where, you know, the world is the self-externalization of the absolute idea of freedom, and so, you know, like, there's a whole metaphysical story that's going on behind the scenes here. But there's this idea that, the best art, the highest art, is that which represents human freedom the most, which shows us ourselves as we truly are, which is in this kind of Kantian, Hegelian, German idea of a story. It's not about the me, it's about this kind of abstract functional structure. So those are kind of two different substantive rather than formal approaches to freedom. Now, here's the synthesis I'd like to draw here, which is, I think you can unite those two formal sides by thinking of beauty as what I'd call unconditional value. So value is anything that motivates action. Something is valuable when it motivates action one way or the other. And a very straightforward way of viewing this is to say, what is it to say that one painting is more beautiful than another? Lots of things there, but at the heart of it, I think you have to say that basically it means that there's some kind of counterfactual situation, like say you're in a burning gallery, right? Right. You can only save one painting. Which one do you save? You save the more beautiful one. If that was not incorporated in the meaning of the term beauty, right? It wouldn't be an account of this special value that beauty beauty has been throughout that, the history of philosophy. There's lots of complicated things I could say there, but I think, but specifically, beauty is unconditional value, which is to say, it's value which does not consist in instrumental value. So, like, my phone has real loads of instrumental value because it's useful for doing a whole bunch of things. It's very it's necessary for doing those things, right? But beauty comes from a certain kind of independence from instrumentality. Now, what's interesting is I think that this independence can be viewed in two ways. I think it can be viewed as either relative or absolute independence. So, absolute independence is the kind of thing Kant's talking about when he's talking about disinterestedness. Like, you know, gallery art, when it's good, right, it shouldn't do anything specifically. It shouldn't have any particular purpose, right? Whereas, take one of my favourite examples, the Great State and Kidney Pie. The Great State and Kidney Pie is a work of art, right? But it's not independent of all purposes. I really want to eat it, right? But there's a certain sense in which it is unconditional in its value because it's better than it needs to be. And this is where we get into the substantive story, because that's what gets called supererogation. Being better than it needs to be, being excessive. Now, I think you can basically give this split between disinterested and interested art in terms of relative and absolute unconditional value, a substantive dimension, by basically saying it's about the enhancement of freedom. Rather than Hegel, for which it's basically just confronting us with our own freedom, actually what beauty is concretely enhancing freedom. So in supererogation, this is really obvious, because when people make things that are better than they should be, what they're doing is giving you additional options, right? They're expanding the space of possible action, right, in a very concrete way. But I think the same story can be told about what we might want to think of as more absolutely unconditional value, stuff which is more associated with the beauty of art. And I think that's where Kant's story about inspiration comes in. Rather than supererogation, what you have here is inspiration. You have the stimulation of our abilities to make decisions, to understand the world and to act in the world in such a way that you expand the space of human freedom, but you don't do it through any particular avenue. It's not like, well, we've got a particular project we're going to engage in here where we're going to try and increase what we can do. It's the flight of fancy of imagination. Like, we don't know where this is going to go, but let's see if it just kind of enhances and enriches human life, right? Okay. Is everybody following me here? Am I not completely ridiculous? Okay, right.
Yeah, I don't think that art has any unconditional value. So, I mean, it just sounds like a German romanticism.
This is not romanticism. This is really not romanticism.
There's
but it is very German.
There's no such thing as unconditional value, particularly in art.
Well, I mean,
I can't understand how you can sort of divorce that from
can we bracket this and you can see where I'm going with it and then come with it back to it later? Is there any other clarificatory issues though, rather than disagreements? And we'll get to it. No? Okay, right, how am I doing? Right, I'll try and rush through this. Right, okay, so remember what I said about liberalism. Liberalism, I define as freedom as caprice, which is to say, it doesn't understand what lies behind decision. The conception of freedom in liberalism starts with we make decisions. And so all it can deal with is what can you do, what can't you do, not the stuff lying behind it. But beauty, as far as I'm concerned, you can't understand without getting behind that, without having the deeper understanding of freedom, because I think fundamentally beauty is about freedom. Now, this takes on a much more interesting, more political dimension once you start thinking about collective freedom. And I just threw out the word collective freedom, as far as I'm concerned, is just justice. Right? This is what justice is. Justice is collective freedom. And I'm going to get even more German here insofar as I'm going to explain what Hegel means by spirit, as far as I'm concerned. Right? When Hegel's talking about spirit, or like collective consciousness, or collective rationality, anything like this, he's actually saying something very concrete, right? Which is, remember what I said, like Kant gives you this qualitative account of what freedom is, which is independent of any particular material it's instantiated. What Hegel does is he comes along and goes, what about if you make a rational agent out of other rational agents? What about if you get like a bunch of rational agents together and you configure them in such a way that they themselves become a rational agent? And that's spirit, right? It's like a recursive freedom, right? So it's collective rationality. And there's a lot of things that I could say about this. I should probably skip a whole bunch of them. I think what's very interesting about this is once you start thinking about justice in this way, you realise that justice is a task, not an archetype. So, like, the problem with Plato, I mean, there's many problems with Plato, but one of the big problems with Plato is when he talks about ideas, like justice, well, he treats them as archetypes. So the idea of justice is the archetype of the perfect state, and so the Republic is all about going through this archetypal perfect state, right? Whereas actually, if you think in these terms, justice isn't a perfect state. Justice is a task. It's the task of making out of ourselves a collective agent, right? And not just making out of ourselves a functioning qualitative collective agent, but making a really good one, which is to say, making one which is as free as it can be, right? So it's actually about maximising collective freedom. Now, of course, then you get into these issues where it's like, but what about the freedom of the individuals within the state? And there, I think the point is that actually what justice is about is not just making ourselves into a larger body, because, you know, we could all just get kind of like strapped together and turned into some kind of horrific mass organism that would be horribly oppressive to all of us, but it could do loads of things, right? We'd be part of it in one sense, but not part of it in another. There wouldn't be consent or anything like that, right? To understand justice properly is about understanding the proper relationship between individual freedom and collective freedom. And basically, I put it in these terms. I think it's about seeing the collective that we create out of ourselves as a way of trading off our individual freedoms. So like we can go, right, okay, well, we'll give up some of our individual freedoms to gain some other individual freedoms that can only be had through collectivization. So justice is this kind of way of enhancing individual freedom through collectivization. But you can't understand that. You can't understand it in like sort of weird quantitative terms. Like, you know, you can't focus group or market it. It's structural. It's about how do we create this thing which is itself free. So I make a loose distinction between what I call integrative and ampliative freedom. So integrative freedom is precisely what liberalism has always been concerned with. How do we not step on each other's toes? How do we make it so that, like, my freedoms don't suppress your freedoms? And that's important, right? But there's also what I'd call ampliative freedom, which is how do we come together and enhance our freedom together? How do we collectivise in such a way that we all get more freedom? And you can start to see how this comes into beauty again. Because if you think of beauty as being about enhancing freedom, then suddenly justice becomes about creating a beautiful state. Right, the task of creating, making out of ourselves something beautiful. And I just say that, like, basically the problem with liberal justice, and this is basically everything that comes out of Rawls. I think Rawls himself is probably more interesting, but like pretty much everybody who uses them, they just essentially ignore ampliative freedom. So it's that's how liberalism turns freedom as caprice into justice as just kind of like avoiding each other, like isolating one another, rather than the understanding collectivization. So what I advocate coming out of this as a sort of accelerationist idea is illiberal justice. Right? We start with this kind of stripped down and reworked like conception of freedom that comes out of German idealism. We should turn it into an illiberal notion of justice, which is about beauty. It's about supererogation and inspiration. And supererogation and inspiration are that they roughly, not entirely, but they roughly correspond to a sort of local and global level, whereby the aim is, right, in your life, in society here, how do you create things that are better than they need to be within these local areas of society? How do you create things that are better than they need to be? And the global concern is, well, how do we instigate a kind of social imagination that is capable of producing new and better ideas for all of this other stuff? Right? And that's, I think, the role of art. The role that art should play should be to kind of constitute a collective space of social imagination, which is about inspiration and enhancing freedom in that sense. So to just kind of very briefly respond to the criticism earlier. Really, in essence, I kind of agree with you in that when I talk about beauty as unconditional value, I don't really think there's such a thing as absolutely unconditional value. Right? I think it's always fundamentally linked into human practice. But if you're too obsessed with use value, you fail to see the importance of excess, the importance of doing things better than they need to be done, right? Because doing so opens up additional possibilities for doing more things. Now, I have a whole additional spiel I give about the extremes of liberalism and where it leads, but I'm just going to stop there, because I'm still within my timer, so I'm quite pleased. Right.